And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
Have you ever thought about what previous civilizations must have thought as they lived through the changes that either spelled their ascension to power or had to adapt to their falling from grace? Babylonians, Greeks, Romans, Persians, Austrian. These are the headings of the history of empire. Today, we hear about the sudden collapse, perhaps, of a most unique empire, as we head as far north as one can go to hear the news from the North Polar regions. Better listen quick, because it's a brand new world coming up here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
We live in a world of wild speculation. Everyone has an opinion of the truth. And depending on who you are, your opinion can change the course of history. That certainly is the case when it comes to the future of our little planet. Speculation, which in many cases is couched as science, can have enormous effects on our sense of well-being. As it certainly did as we headed into this hurricane season, what with Katrina celebrating her second birthday and the specter that global warming could make this hurricane season the worst on record. Well, so far, somewhat ordinary. Here on Earth, we're hearing about global warming, mass extinction, peak oil, and the like. And speculators, scientists, and people with good common sense can't even begin to agree on what this is all supposed to mean. Strangely, the debate over global warming serves as a fulcrum upon which our future seems to rest. And to date, the debate has been tipping one way or the other. Reason is a reasonable thing, unless, of course, there are factors that one cannot factor in. That just may be the case in this debate. And today, we hear the latest news from the North Polar regions about that elusive ice cap upon which indigenous peoples and polar bears must depend for the traditional ways of life. Now, if you are a polar bear, or if you think much about them, then you need to listen up and listen good, because the news is, well, that's coming up in segment two. We'll hear from Dr. Walt Myers, research scientist with the National Snow and Science Data Center in Boulder, Colorado. It is time to pay attention. We'll hear that and the latest nature news, but first, as always, it's time for the weekly Earth Summit. Welcome to the Weekly Earth Summit. Today, our regular panelists provide an overview of thought on issues and observations of our world and your future. So now, we're pleased to open this week's summit with a challenge for all of us from Dr. Matthew Sleeth, who just returned from a month traveling around the country, bringing a call to action to the nation's faith communities.
I have been to the mountain, and it was not there. This is not poetry, but the reality I confronted a week ago in eastern Kentucky. The Appalachian Mountains are being laid to waste in an operation called mountaintop removal. More accurately, it is the mountaintop, middle, bottom, and valley that is destroyed in the process of extracting the 3-foot seam of coal that fuel America's energy needs. Only a poet could do justice to the phenomenon of the missing mountain. It is a hard thing to get my mind around, much less my soul. I lack the skill to convey my horror. Thousands of years ago, a Hebrew poet penned the 148th Psalm, and I quote, "Praise the Lord from the earth, you great sea creatures in all ocean depths, lightning and hail, snow and clouds, stormy winds that do his bidding, you mountains and hills," end quote. How many of those things which glorify our Creator and give beauty to our world will be laid to waste in an effort to fulfill our wants. The answer is in our hands every time we turn on a clothes dryer, television, or lamp. Moses received the Ten Commandments on a mountain, and Jesus preached his greatest sermon on one. He said that if we had the faith, we could move mountains. Now I pray that the same power can preserve the mountain. Lastly, seeing mountains removed and valley streams buried brings into vivid reality the childish notion that we can use non-renewable resources and then pay a fee to offset the result. Once a mountain is destroyed, it is gone, and no carbon indulgence paid can offset or mitigate the sin of its removal.
Thank you, Dr. Sleeth. Dave Foreman has served in years past on the board of the Sierra Club. As always, he cuts his own path to tomorrow and invites those brave enough to follow.
In my 35 years as a conservationist, I have never beheld such a bleak and depressing situation as I see today. The evidence for my despair falls into three categories: the state of nature, the power of anti-conservationists, and appeasement and weakness within the conservation and environmental movements. I fear that on some level, we must recognize that this state of affairs may be inevitable and impossible to turn around. That is the coward's way out, though. The bleakness we face is all the more reason to stand tall for our values and to not flinch in the good fight. In December of 1776, the American Revolution was in its darkest hour. In response, Tom Paine wrote his first crisis paper. "These are the times that try men's souls. The summer soldier and the sunshine patriot will, in this crisis, shrink from the service of his country. But he that stands it now deserves the love and thanks of man and woman." General Washington had the paper read to his miserable, disheartened troops in their frozen winter camps. There was no surrender. Years of hard battle lay ahead, but victory was gained. We need Tom Paine conservationists in our dark hour. Let us not apologize for loving wild nature, for caring about other species, for speaking the truth. Reach out to others. Make deals when they are good deals. But let us not be frightened and browbeaten into appeasement. Let us instead offer a bold, hopeful vision for how wilderness and civilization can live together.
Thanks, Dave. Ben Lowe is like a young Dave Foreman, an activist and effective voice for the earth. He speaks specifically on behalf of the incredible faith-based community, which is quickly emerging as a powerful and effective friend of the earth. Ben?
I just got back from four nights of camping in Boise, Idaho. Idaho is a beautiful state with many great camping spots, but this time I was not in the hills or by a river. This time I was camping in the field behind the Vineyard Boise Church. I was joined by a diverse group of students, Christian environmentalists, and church leaders, many who opted to stay in local hotels instead. Word on the street is that all the cool kids were actually camping, though. We came together for what was a very encouraging Creation Care Summit, filled with worship, prayer, learning, and fellowship. We heard reports from the Reverend Richard Cizik, Vice President for Governmental Affairs of the National Association of Evangelicals, and many other pastors, leaders, and organizations. Everyone present testified that there has been a sea change among Christians in the last few years. A building majority of evangelicals are recovering a vision for environmental stewardship and are taking action all across the nation. Our host church is just one such example. Led by their senior pastor, Tri Robinson, the Vineyard Boise Church in Idaho headed up a recycling ministry in their parking lot called Tithe Your Trash. They plant a large organic garden on site and donate the produce to families in the community, along with goods for their food pantry. Members of the church also frequently work with local rangers to clear trails and plant trees in the nearby wilderness areas. I came back from this conference greatly encouraged. What an inspiring model of community-based environmental stewardship, and a mere foretaste of all the good work God is preparing for us to do.
Thanks, Ben. You can find out about Ben's work by visiting aroca.org, A-R-O-C-H-A dot O-R-G. Dr. Charles Kennell is forging the Sustainability Institute at the University of California, San Diego. He brings to this task a wide and rich awareness of the state of the ark. I welcome Dr. Kennel to share his thoughts. Dr. Kennel?
The 2007 IPCC report projects a global warming of 0.2 degrees centigrade per decade over the next 2 decades, twice what we experienced at the end of the 20th century. But even if we could hold greenhouse gas and aerosol concentrations back at their year 2000 level, which we have not done and cannot do, we're going to get 0.1 degree per decade for a century or more. And this means that no matter what we do about fossil fuel use, we'll have to adapt to the climate change that's already in store for us. And in particular, California and the American West are going to have to cope with the long-term drying trend. People don't live on the globe. They live in regions and communities. They have their own environments, their ecologies, economics, politics, and social attitudes. While the IPCC can forecast the global drivers of regional climate change, they can't be expected to understand the needs of the citizens living in every region of the world. California has 16 distinct climatic regions, as anyone who drives inland from the ocean can easily appreciate. And Californians care about their 16 regions. We need to do our own assessments. We're already leading the way. The California Energy Commission's Our Changing Climate Assessment set the context with the agreements between California and the UK and amongst the 5 western states, all to cooperate on climate change. This shows how regional assessments, how influential they can be. Assessments are going to have to become a way of life for California. State agencies will use them in important water management and natural hazard decisions. How high and when should we rebuild the levees in the Sacramento Delta? Farmers and the banking institutions that finance agriculture need them. The Department of Forestry will use their wildfire forecast. Energy companies will use their forecasts of electricity usage and hydropower generation in making their investment decisions. Environmental managers in our cities, towns, and parks will use them. The protection of California's ecosystems and wildlife will depend on them. Fisheries managements will use them. In 10 years' time, climate science may be able to reduce the lead time of its forecast to 10 years. This would give highly actionable information to investors and government, and we should adopt this as a goal for California now.
Regional thinking is where you live. Perhaps the term bioregional perspective may stage a comeback. Thank you, Dr. Kennel. We are all in this together. Dr. Thomas Lovejoy knows this as well as anyone. Dr. Lovejoy, thanks for your thoughts this week.
Now, we recently had the report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change about the impacts of climate change on the natural world. And I think it's quite clear now that the natural world is the most sensitive of all the things we care about that can be affected by climate change. We're seeing changes in nature all over the world, changes in flowering time, changes in nesting time, species changing where they live, changing in altitude, changing in latitude. We're seeing mismatches where one species in a relationship depends on day length, the other depends on temperature, and suddenly they're no longer in sync. And we're seeing thresholds passed in ecosystems so that, for example, in the Northwest and British Columbia and Southern Alaska, the coniferous forests are suddenly being attacked in a major way by a native pest, the pine bark beetle, but with warmer summer nights and essentially longer summers, suddenly the balance is tipped in their favor. So there are places where 70% of the trees are dead. So basically, if we allow climate change to go on business as usual and get worse, we're going to see the very biological underpinnings of human society be shaken in an unprecedented way. So nature is telling us it's time to get the climate change and greenhouse gas problem under control.
In order to truly build a global response, it will take the united efforts of professionals from around the globe. Building that effort through action, we now invite Dr. Robin Moore to invite everyone around the world interested in the future of amphibians to begin building that united effort. Dr. Moore?
In September 2005, over 60 of the world's leading experts in amphibian conservation and research convened in Washington, D.C. for an amphibian summit. This summit was a response to mounting evidence over the preceding decades that amphibians have been going extinct and declining worldwide. This realization prompted the global community to come together to formulate a response. The summit tackled a number of themes from disease, climate change, captive breeding and reintroduction, to develop a global strategy in the form of the Amphibian Conservation Action Plan. This action plan will be published within the next couple of months. Associated with the action plan was a budget of $400 million. This is the amount it was estimated it would cost to halt the crisis. Prior to the summit, a number of disparate bodies had been tackling amphibian conservation at the global scale. The Declining Amphibian Populations Task Force had made amazing advances in our knowledge of amphibian declines worldwide. The Global Amphibian Assessment had provided an update on the status of amphibians and continues to provide an update on the status. Following the summit, it was realized that a unified global entity was required to tackle the problem at the scale necessary. This led to the formation of the Amphibian Specialist Group, into which the Declining Amphibian Populations Task Force folded, and the Global Amphibian Assessment will also fold. If you'd like more information about the Amphibian Specialist Group, including the bi-monthly newsletter Froglog, which details the activities of the Amphibian Specialist Group and amphibian researchers working in the field, please visit the website www.amphibians.org.
We must unite our observations of the changes taking place. That means we all have to pay attention to the real world around us. Dr. Mark Beckhoff sends us onward with some of his observations on how paying attention to the wild creatures applies to our broader lives. Dr. Beckhoff.
Yeah, one of the really interesting things that I try to do is people ask me, well, what does knowing about animal behavior do for you in terms of encountering a wild animal? I'll say, well, when you see a mountain lion, you're supposed to stand upright and scream and make yourself really big. If you have a bike, wave the bike. If you have a stick, wave the stick. Of course, what I've done in the past when I've had the lion encounters is I run, because that's what you instinctively do. But people are also interested in practical issues, like what happens when a real aggressive dog comes up to you. Well, what I generally do is I turn and walk away very slowly. Sometimes I'll face the dog, but generally I'll turn around and I'll walk away slowly. I won't make any sudden move. I surely won't run away fast, although I want to, because that's like a pursuit invitation signal, we call it. That's an invitation for the animal to chase you. Some people say that if you roll over and you're really scared and you pee in your pants, that might work, and it might. I've never done that. But my tendency with a real aggressive dog is to just get away slowly, simply because they can be pretty unpredictable. And you just, you know, you don't know about the history of the dog. You don't know the dog's psychological makeup. And so by lying down, you may, you know, be exposing a vulnerable part of your body. So I think that, you know, those are sort of lessons from animal behavior. When I encounter coyotes around my house, once again, I walk away slowly. I may say, you know, I may talk to them in a really, really gentle, mellow voice. But, you know, sometimes with a mountain lion, you have to confront them. With this bear on my porch, I didn't know what to do. And, you know, I've heard reports from other people about, you know, bears and even coyotes, that they're so habituated, this bear didn't flinch. He finally ran off my porch when I went to the door, and I was standing at the screen door, and I was starting to close the glass sliding porch door, and I noticed he was backing up a bit. So I opened the door a bit, because I knew I could actually shut it before he could get in it, and I just kind of looked at him, and very gently I said, "What are you doing here? You know, please leave my porch." And then when I stepped towards him, and I was probably only about 3 feet from him, but still protected partly by the door, he ran off the porch. So there's a problem, I think you can see, that with habituated animals, you just don't know what to do. The other problem, of course, is a lot of these animals have been shed, and then they people stop feeding them, and that's the worst of the worst situation. When you read about kids getting attacked by wildlife or even adults, it's because the wildlife have been fed, and then they stop feeding them, and they're accustomed to food.
I want to thank this great alliance of advocates that will be meeting and sharing their thoughts each week on the weekly Earth Summit here on the Wild Side News. Now do what you can, which means to spread the word about the most important 15 minutes on Earth until we convene again next week. This is your host, Sidney Wildsmith. See you then. One of the greatest stories ever written was Alice in Wonderland, where the poor Alice found herself in a world of changing realities, much of which was out of her control. That just may be a useful way to look at our own future as the natural balance of life becomes disrupted. In a moment, we're heading up to the North Pole as we get brought up to date on the latest about the elusive Arctic ice. Alice may have said it best when she mused, "Curiouser and curiouser." Stay tuned.
I'm getting a catcher's mitt.
I'm getting ice skates.
I'm getting a jigsaw puzzle.
I'm getting dying coral reefs.
A blue bicycle.
A walkie-talkie.
I'm getting a severe drought.
Cool black skateboard.
I'm getting melted ice caps.
A killer heat wave.
A shrinking glacier.
I'm getting a devastating flood.
Adults are generous. We're even giving kids global warming. But it's not too late. We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. Go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.